It doesn't matter how much you've spent on the room if the position is wrong. It doesn't matter how much you've spent on your speakers if the position is wrong. The easiest, cheapest thing you can do to walk towards your goals of a room in which it's easy to make decisions and decisions translate is position your speakers where they goddamn should be.
Yeah.
And position yourself where you then therefore have to be. That's like 80% of the work.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is acoustician and studio designer Hush Paz. Hush's company Sense and Sound offers an exclusive studio in a day service where they design, install, and calibrate your studio acoustics in just one day. Among many clients that have utilized this service include mixer DJ Swivel, film composer Sam Ewing, producer-composer Mike Woods, and video game audio company Hexany Audio. Hush has also designed his own unique acoustic panels, as well as smart legs for super simple installation. During the interview, we talked about how Studio in a Day works, why speaker placement in a room is so important, how cable degradation influences the sound, how he developed his acoustic panels, and much more. I spoke with Hush from his studio in Los Angeles. Let's start here, then. I think everybody wants to know about the Studio in a Day.
Well, the general idea started when I decided to piece together a company, and acoustics is one of the directions I went through. I won't go into the back end at this point because you're asking about Studio in a Day. And I was just asking myself, what would it look like if this were easy? How could I simplify the 10,000 hour headache and, you know, 100,000 decisions that go into a project of assembling a studio? That's the biggest pain point, both for the designer and for the person who just wants a studio. And so I asked myself, what would it look like if it were easy? And the answer to that was always just like, well, it's just there and there, right there in the same day, right? It has to, if it's in your room and you're like, this or this, you'll go, I want that. If you have to read about it, understand what they mean, visualize it, imagine it, and then make a decision for every decision, then, you know, there's now a varying degree of headache that this is for the consumer. So I just like, okay, well, the easiest form of studio design is if it happens in your home on the day, you know, all decisions made for you, your hand held as you walk through the decisions for an easy buying experience, but forget buying, for an easy decision-making experience for your needs. And then I just reversed engineered the entire company from there to be able to do that. And so the premise of it is, you know, try before you buy. It's instead of reading about things and understanding and figuring out what you need and consulting and getting quotes and then revising the quotes and then figuring out what the fabric you need is because you're ordering the thing, they have to make it. We show up with the systems that's relevant for your room. We bring it in. We do a core speaker placement. We demo if needed. Half the times the clients are like, do what you think, and then we just get to it. But if the client wants to hear and make decisions, then we demo, we set it up for them with a core speaker placement, say, this sounds like this, and the panels are over here, and they look this way. And then the client goes, okay, yeah, good. Or, okay, and how much is that? It's 10 grand. And they're like, okay, what can we knock off out of here? And then I'll go, well, the lowest priority panels are these. Out. And then the client goes, well, I didn't really care about that difference, so that's fine. And then, okay, great. What's the next thing? Okay, next panel I'll remove is that one. And then we take that out, and the client goes, no, put that one back. and then you're making decisions with certainty, and you're making them there on the spot. They're not tasking for you. And then we agree on what we want. The client says, fine, this is what I'm getting. We commit it to the wall. You know, install it on the wall if they want. If it's on legs, it's on legs. And then we get to, what fabrics do you want? And I essentially pushed the fabric decision to the end so that to remove it from the manufacturing process. And then the way we did that is we just created Velcro-attached removable covers. And so the whole process happens with just black fabrics that are the transport fabrics. And you're not dealing with the visuals at all. You're just dealing with the sound, the design, the objects, where they stand, functionality. And then at the end, I go, if I could put up an Arabic accent, I would, but I can't. You know, which fabrics do you want? And usually I actually leave them for a week with it because it takes a while. It's the hardest decision for people to make what they want the thing to look. And then they tell us and we order it. And we just come back a couple weeks later and redress the panels in about an hour or two. And in the meantime, I'm finishing the speaker calibration. and any collecting any sort of details about other things that need to do to need need to happen, or custom things that maybe can't be done on the day, and you know, give the keys back to the user and leave.
Now, obviously, we're just talking about acoustic treatment and not isolation. So what happens with someone that wants isolation?
Isolation is not done in a day.
Yeah.
Isolation is construction. Isolation is highly case-specific assessments, whether it's the case of what's the structure you're starting with to the case of what are your actual needs. You know, one guy with maybe very bass-heavy speakers has one need. A drummer has a very different need. And they don't have, I wouldn't make the same decisions for these two cases. It's just a highly custom advisory and design-oriented service. And then a contractor is needed to implement. I am not a contractor. I'm not legally allowed to build anything. Walls, that is. And now you're dealing with a third party. I really try to stay away from construction is better than the plague, apparently. But, you know, when construction is needed, it's needed.
Okay, so a lot of clients, they'll have a bedroom or something that's less than ideal to start with. There'll be windows, like in my room, for instance, there's windows, or there's doors or closets or whatever that are suboptimal. So what do you do then?
I make the decisions as best for the geometry. Sound is a geometric function. And acoustics, or the way I run this company, or the way we kind of are able to make such fast decisions in a day, wait, your picture froze, there we go, is that I've formulized a positioning scheme, and I've formulized kind of classes of decisions for given cases. So there'll be a custom case with a weird shape or a closet somewhere. Yeah, I'll need to be creative in that decision, and that's what I'm there for. The rest of the times, it's like, well, speakers need to be here. The geometry of the room dictates the speakers are going to be here. It might be a little there, but it's this orientation. That means we need panels here and here and here. And the panels are, the panel positions are, I divide them into three cases. You have bass balancing positions. You have modal balancing positions, balancing the modal behavior of the room. And then you have early reflections or first reflections, if you want to call them, positions. And each of them have a function that they serve. They somewhat overlap. But based on this hierarchy of classification, I can prioritize the decision-making and go, okay, well, because of the closet there, you know, the only potential for actual symmetry in the room is going to have to be here. And so let's take the closet doors off. And now it's a strange shape acoustically, but the reflection is really only seeing the back of the closet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and kind of look for the most ideal decisions that would lead to the most symmetrical shape with the best response I can envision happening in this room as the client's needs dictate. And if the client's needs are beyond what the room will provide, I will then advise them this, you know, the best we can do in this room is probably under your needs. We should look for a different room. If that's the answer, that's the answer.
I know that, and I see it with my followers, my subscribers, that they have a room that's basically put a workstation in and a couple of speakers, and the placement of everything is less than ideal. And I'm telling them, look, at the very least, come out from the wall and also be equidistant from each wall if you can. And pushback I'll get sometimes is, yeah, but this is the only place I can put it. Do you run into that?
I do. I disarm that very quickly. I'd say any room I walk into, whatever the caliber, it could be a mega corporation doing exporting, you know, post-production for Netflix. It could be some guy in his bedroom. It could be a major studio. 80% of them, position is wrong. Just wrong. It doesn't matter how much you've spent on the room if the position is wrong. It doesn't matter how much you spent on your speakers if the position is wrong. The easiest, cheapest thing you can do to walk towards your goals of a room in which it's easy to make decisions and decisions translate is position your speakers where they goddamn should be.
Yeah.
And position yourself where you then therefore have to be. That's like 80% of the work. and your $13,000 speakers are absolutely meaningless in the wrong place. They'll sound nice, they'll still be very impressive, but they won't translate. And so it's just having the authority of a studio designer. I find that people don't argue with me unless it's important to them over the results, in which case that's fine. That's the correct decision for their needs. If they're like, I will sacrifice these bunch of holes in the bass and the wrong panning image and the fact that the balance of the mids to the sides is going to be wrong because I need the space for creatives. And what we're really focused in here is, you know, musical decisions and writing. And if that stuff is not quite up to par, not as crucial, like that's what that room needs. I just find I don't really get often called to those rooms because I'm not, unless it's a friend and they just want a word. But if I'm paid to provide an opinion, usually somebody wants the room to translate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, let's talk about speakers then. Do you recommend certain speakers or does it matter to you?
I have found that I've had to update my opinions of speakers throughout. And I essentially find out that I can't really bear much of an opinion about a speaker until I've got to place it in the room. And so when I go into a room and then there's whatever speakers that the customer has, and now I'm placing the speakers, I'm doing speaker placement, and I put them here and I move them there and they move around a bit, I get the averaging of the differences and I'm able to put to one side the difference, which is now the room, and be left with the speaker's actual response and actually have an opinion about the speaker. And I also get to, it gives me an opportunity to see how the speaker's dispersion interacts with the room as you move it in different places, more so if I get to place the same speaker in different kind of rooms, just some of the speakers repeat. Only then can I really bear witness to what I think about the speaker. And any opinion I had before is just thrown out the window immediately. And I have had the same experience for microphones, as I felt I had a strong opinion about this or that, and then I discovered cable degradation, which was invisible to me, and mapped it out as part of my attempt to formalize the fidelity formula, everything that contributes to the resultant sound. So I can actually say, well, you know, these are the factors. And then I discovered, oh, I have no idea what a Royer ribbon sounds, which before I hated, thought it was awful, didn't understand what the hype was about. I'm like, oh yeah, but the studio I had at the time in London had just god-awful cables and a Studer console with caps that couldn't be replaced sooner. And so my opinion is irrelevant, you know, that I did not hear the microphone. And so it's the same with speakers. And I have found that the differences between speakers are shockingly smaller than one might think. Generally, if you're buying a pro monitor, a pro audio level monitor these days, you can expect to get something within the range of your expense. If you're buying a $1,000-ish range pair of monitors, there's betters and worse, sure. None of them suck. I used to think Rockets are not great. And then I did a tiny-ass surround room for someone, and he had a pair of Rocket 5s, and we placed them. And I'm like, these things go down to 40. The mid-range resolution is consistent. The treble's nice. This is great. I was completely surprised. This is $150 speakers. Obviously, it doesn't sound like, you know, ATC 45s. But placed correctly with the acoustics done, I'm like, this room is now easy to make decisions in. They would translate. I still think you need a sub, but if you didn't have a sub, you could still work. And so I would say more often than not, speakers are good. And the differences between them from a practical perspective of what is practically contributing to your ability to do your job is a smaller difference, like almost insignificant difference compared to position and acoustic response and room shape to begin with. Even if the room was naked, just you can lose with the wrong room shape or win with the right room shape. That is not to say, I love ATCs. I love the new series of the PMCs and the IB1Ss. I just got to place Dutch and Dutch for the first time. That was an experience. There are speakers I don't like. I'll not mention them right now. There are speakers I literally hate. And that's more to do with their functional dispersion than anything else. But all of them are workable. And there's also surprising things like Kali audio speakers, which are like $400. And then, you know, two three-way tops with a sub set you back $1,300. And if you, it's a very light speaker. So if you fasten it to the stand or put some stones on it or whatever, just to add some mass, it's shocking resolution for the price point. I kind of try to identify within each price range who the stars are, and then that's what I keep sending people to. So in the 1,000-ish range of expense, like Kali Audios to me is beating things. It doesn't have, some speakers have a more luscious feel, but I will take a more consistent resolution across the frequency range and dynamic range, even if the feel of the speaker is less luscious, over something that the mids sound soft and luscious or whatever, but like the treble and the mids are different, and the subs and the mids are different or whatever, and then there's an inconsistency in the way the speaker spits out sound. And I find like I'd rather have a speaker that doesn't feel quite as good, but just is just more consistent and correct. So I would say Kali Audio in the $1,000 range. In the $1,000 to $8,000 range is a wild west of options, and it's very much a taste thing. The character of the sound, the each speaker having its advantages, maintainability or durability of the speaker. You know, you've got speakers that are the design are more to do with how can you use the tool you have more than, and if you know how to use the tool you have more than anything, like Amphions are a simple design. There's no limiter. It's a passive thing. It's whatever you signal you send to that speaker, it's moving according to that speaker. And that's dangerous because you have to know how to use this tool. It's very easy to push that speaker into compression and it won't tell you. You won't know. The amp isn't protecting against it. And so if you don't know how to use this tool, it will affect your translation. It'll make you make incorrect decisions. And the speaker didn't do anything wrong. It's the user case. You can't do that as easily with, an active speaker with limiters on, like the thing behind me, or most speakers really. So I say in the 1,000 to $8,000 range of expense, you have a wild list of options that is hard to each have their own case. The coaxial designs of the ones by Genelec, which as a point source are really useful in a spatial configuration. They do have a lot of benefits from, it's just an impressive speaker, but I've also found, you know, putting mechanical statistics to one side, I found it slightly strange to work on, having had to mix on them in different places. There's something I'm not a huge fan about in this speaker. It just hits a certain way. There's something in the dynamics of it, in the punch of it, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And you know, my customers who have this have no complaints. They like the speaker. Their work translates. That's all you need to know. That's just my personal preference. It doesn't have the softness of an ATC. Great. I can masturbate to that as much as I want. It doesn't functionally mean anything. In the above 8,000 range, it's hard to go wrong. It's things don't stay around in that market if no one's buying. And, you know, there are speakers I don't like and don't recommend, but I don't think any of them suck.
Yeah, I get it. Okay. I use Amphions, by the way. So
there you go. Do you have the larger ones or the smaller ones?
No, I have the 118s.
The 118s with a sub?
No sub. I'm in a small room.
And you're not going too loud?
No, not at all. But that being said, what's your take on speaker cable for passive speakers?
Well, cables in general is, let's call this the category of degradation. It's probably is one of the latest things I ended up learning or mapping out. And I wish I had mapped it out sooner. I might have saved myself a lot of headaches in my, production career, engineering career. But I pay a lot of attention to it now. It's a vast case-specific circumstance degradation, but it's in everything. It's in power, it's in line level cables, it's in mic level cables, it's in guitar level cables, instrument level, it's in speaker or headphone level cables. You know, if you just pay attention to degradation and design it to minimize it in your system, you're winning so much. And I found also that, you know, we're past the age of compression to some extent, having backed off a bit from the peak compression era. But, modern music loves compression. And I have found that a lot of compression is compensating for degradation caused in somewhere in the chain, probably in, you know, serial sets of cables. That is one form of degradation that happens in cables is that very sharp resonances accumulate in different places, and they're not musically correlated. They're just here. And so energy around that tends to activate the resonance and get stolen into it and create an inconsistency in response between one note or another, or one range of frequencies in another. And it may be in the treble, instead of the treble being easily spaced out, it concentrates around 9K for some reason. That's sharp resonance. It's too sharp for our hearing, doesn't work that way. It averages it out. But the energy still gets altered, gets modified from how it was. And then you're like, oh, I'm not getting the impact I need. And so you're trying to compress it. If you eliminate a lot of degradation, oftentimes the signal as it was is good. And you're like, yeah, fade it up. Good. Yeah, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and you move on. Speaker cables are the lowest, are the place where it has the smallest amount of potential to happen. Every degradation that I've observed with my ears in one project or another on speaker cables was definitely the smallest modification out of all cables. But it's there. And it's there the longer the run, the longer it's there. From there on, it's also a matching of, you know, the load that it's attached to and the amplifier it's coming to. So some circumstances would prefer one cable, some would ring with another. A lot of this from the cable manufacturers, they treat it as voicing. They treat it as taste more than this is more correct, that is less correct. That being said, there's things that I would say are technically less correct. It's all about materials, surround materials, surprisingly, more than the conductor, as I have found, alter the behavior of the sound. More than that, I can't say. It's too vague and random and black magic. It's taking me working along a cable manufacturer named Ken Goris, who's kind of introduced me to cable degradation and with whom I've researched a lot of this. So it's taken me just trial and error, hands-on experience and listening tests, blind listening tests done in the most boring fashion to start and map out what's the contributory component that cables are doing. And I didn't do enough about passive speaker cables to have enough of a concrete opinion to say that's the cable and you want this in this case. So I don't want to talk out of my ass. But I have found that the PVC or surrounding materials of the cable seem to affect the ability of the electricity to flow across time. It affects the slew rate. It affects differently across different dynamics of energy levels. And I can tell you one material Ken Gore specifically absolutely detests is PVC.
Hi, I'm Bobby Osinski, and I'm a best-selling author of several books on recording, mixing, and mastering that are considered the gold standard by many. I recently created a new resource for songwriters, artists, bands, and producers, and anyone looking to fix common mixing problems so they can get a better result, stop wasting time experimenting, and not get buried in information overload. I'm calling it the Mix Fix Playbook. 15 quick solutions to common mix problems. These fixes are well known among top mixing pros, but you probably never knew they existed. If you're looking to create mixes that stand up to what you hear on the radio, Spotify, or TV, go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. All right, get it. I got it. Give me some of your background. Tell me how you developed into a studio designer.
Well, I came into recording and engineering. I was a pianist, a bit of a musician, you know, a teenager kid, drawn to music, always very technical, you know, took my dad's stereo apart, whatever, didn't piece it back together. I was in Israel. I'm from Israel originally. And at the time, this is 2003, this is just the beginning of the uprise of the pro-consumer accessible interfaces and, you know, Cubase 2. My dad was a computer guy, so he assembled computers in the house from parts. And I had a little 10 by 10 room with, you know, carpets and egg cartons on the wall and two PA speakers and a Behringer MXA 8000 that I bought from Mauer Applebaum, if you know who that is.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
Yeah, so back in the day. And I would record bands in there, and I kind of pieced it together as a rehearsal studio for some punk band I was in, and then suddenly I can record. And I had, you know, four channels to record in. And so I would record the band live into two and the drums into two. And then, you know, do the vocals after, like a half live circumstance. And suddenly I'm in business. I did it for my song one time, and I couldn't play everything quite well enough. And so I got other musicians to replace my parts. And then they brought their bands. And then they brought their, and suddenly I'm in business. And I didn't know it at the time, but it was just me and maybe one other guy in our town that really had this, this set circumstance with audio interface and setup. And so I found myself in business, and I found myself diving more and more into sound and production. And, you know, I had a crew of musicians develop around me, and they bring their projects, and it soared from there. Then I built a second studio as we moved, which was a larger facility. We had a control room, a live room, and a dead room, and the bomb shelter, which every house has in Israel, was the, you know, the amp room, and it was convenient. And I ran that for a couple of years. I was an audio engineer in the army, doing live sound. And then, and I was kind of just teaching myself. And that, at this area, there wasn't, YouTube was around at some point for this, but there wasn't anything on it. You know, I would try to search for information. I didn't know about your book about until university, but I couldn't find anything. So I'd had to come up with experiments, conduct them, learn something next. That was kind of all the way up to 2009. And then in 2009, I decided it was after the army. I don't know how to be better from here. Like I don't know how to, learn this anymore. I need to go and learn the actual fundamentals. And so I took it apart, sold it for parts, moved to England. In England, I did the Tonmeister course, if you know of it.
Oh yeah.
And so I was there interested in the theory. Everyone was there interested in the hands-on. I'm like, I don't care about the hands-on. I want to know how this works. So I'm, you know, front row asking questions. So I did that course. I was really interested in acoustics because I've kind of built two spaces by now. And seems, I guess I have spatial intelligence. And so I relate to space a lot. And so in my first rooms, you know, I would drag stuff from the street and just put it in the room, this mattress or whatever. In England, when I moved, I constantly moved houses. I had to set up a new room every time. I had clients. I was already working. You know, I found myself as an engineer in this studio or that studio. And I was trying to, at some point, I at the placement year, I was working at a Dean Street Studios out there until I got fired. And then I found myself with, you know, 8 months left on my placement year. And I didn't know what to do myself. I was living in London now, waiting to go back to finish the course. And so I thought, okay, what's my weakest point? It's mixing. So let's dedicate 8 months to learning how to mix. And so I bought your book, and I bought Mixing with Your Mind, and one other that I don't remember now, read anything I could about mixing and engineering at that time, and took on, give me projects. Everyone give me projects. It kind of serendipitously already arrived. And I just sat there to establish my mixing philosophy, a lot of which borrows from your book and from the that meditation list in the Mixing with Your Mind, and sat there for 8 months to do that, and was absolutely astounded at how much when I returned to university and back into recording, how that completely changed my approach as a recording engineer made everything just work from the start. But as I moved back to London, you know, I'm just constantly moving houses, building another spot for myself to work in, another house, another spot, another house, another spot, helping that friend. I was the guy who does this. And so the people kind of ask me questions. I tried to suck as much information as I could from the acoustics at the Tonmeister course, but it's really set for a certain level. I read as much as I could on papers on that. All of that is very dry information. I was trying to focus on my engineering career. I was renting out a studio later and back in London, you know, producing bands, recording there. The one with the terrible Studer that needed caps and bad cables. That empty room, at some point, I just, again, went into the street, dragged a whole bunch of pallets to create the Fusion, and it was next to garages, and had them install wooden flooring, which creaked, which was a bad decision. but it was all coming. You know, I was working at Smokehouse Studios there, and I wanted to modify the acoustic in one of the rooms there. I was not quite yet aware of speaker placement, which I wish I did. I did not know it at the time, but the monitors I were using were towards dying, and you know, they had moved a couple of countries now, and their bass response was off, and the surround was starting to come off of one of the speakers, which I didn't notice till I moved to the States. And the last room I had there was terrible, which I understand now is the geometry of it was terrible, but I didn't understand that then. I could not find where to put the speakers. I could not do anything to make that room easy to work in. It was the worst kind of room. It was like hard to make decisions in. And finally, when you make the decision, it doesn't even translate. So every mix took 2 weeks, and it had a huge, huge negative impact on my career as a producer, as a someone who's trying to make projects out the door, you know. And then my visa ran out. By that point, I had extended it as a entrepreneur visa, but it ran out now. And my green card for the States, which I was working on for like a decade, had opened up. And they kind of tell you, you know, come to the States or go away. You have 6 months. And so I did. Moved to LA without a plan in a dead decade, industry-wise. Didn't really find myself. You know, I worked a little bit here and there. Didn't really find myself. I didn't have a mixing suite for the first year. And so I lost all the clients that I had. They had to find a different arrangement. And so I was stuck in nowhere land. And I had a lot of sound skills to monetize live engineering, whatever else. I went on tours at some point. I was a house engineer in the Peppermint Club, whatever, different things like that. But I didn't quite find myself. What I did very much notice is the difference between my business acumen and the average American musician's business acumen. Americans are very, very business oriented. And I think I lived here in this room at some point with a guy who was a manager at TDE, Kendrick Lamar's label. And like, I could barely participate in the conversation. I just didn't know. I didn't know enough. I was too focused on content creation. And so I decided I need to understand business and money. I need to figure that out. And I decided, okay, I guess I'm going to start a business. I got tired of artists and inconsistency of the music industry just because of my own path, and decided to open a business as I'm still working within engineering. At some point, I was looking for what is this business going to be. And I was on tour and I was doing this. And then I went to an acoustics lecture just because this is something I'm interested in. And I met Ken Gorris there and Bruce Black, who are both acousticians. I would later come and attend the Sapphire Group, if you know what that is.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I am now a member. So I attended the Sapphire Group and hung out there and started getting work as hands, I guess, another able body in the studio installations and acoustics field. Found it absolutely intuitive for myself, whether I'm just the hands for someone building it in the garage because acoustics is you know, you have to build it somewhere, and most acousticians are somewhat older. Or if it's installing an Atmos speaker system for a Nickelodeon studio, and you know, asking them, okay, what's the tolerance of the positioning? Like, what do you mean? How accurate do you want me to put the speaker in space relative to the spec? Like, I don't know what you're asking me. Should it be 1 cubic inch, 1 cubic foot? Like, 1 cubic inch. Okay. So this calculate how to position 22 speakers in a non-straight space within 1 cubic inch accuracy. And so I found that this was a hungry field where there's a lot of need, but not a lot of supply. A friend was moving to from London to here, and he's like, I bought a house. I need someone to look at it. I need to put a studio there. He's a composer, a film composer. Can you go look? Sure. I went, look, can you piece together a plan for me? Sure. And so I'm scouring all the available acoustic products, coming up with a plan, implementing the plan. Great. Someone else hears that, hey, I heard you just did. Can you do that? Yeah, sure. And then another person. And I think there's like one holy rule in America, which is thou shalt not argue with supply and demand. And so I gave it a name and said, okay, I think I found the business I'm going to do. And I focused on that. And as I'm asking myself, you know, sitting in traffic in LA, what's the thing I'm going to create? How do I solve a problem that someone hasn't solved? It just kept coming back around to how the available products on the market weren't doing the thing that I need them to do. They weren't quite shaped for what I have kept finding that I'm orienting towards in my designs. I learned a lot from Ken Goris implementing his designs. In starting to build panels, I was using his garage. I started discovering things like, this is the thing that helped me get into the Sapphire Group, is I discovered 703 sheets resonate. And so if you just put them there, they resonate. They have a sound. And if you cut them up, because it's a membrane, if you cut them up, they don't resonate. And it changes the sound of the absorption, which is in line for me. I wrote my technical project on drum tuning mechanics. So I extensively researched membranes and membrane behavior and radiance. And so I guess that, you know, it kind of preloaded my brain to that way of thinking. But I was using off-cut pieces of 703 to put into a panel that I built, trying to use the material. And I'm like, this panel sounds better. Why does it sound better? And then I started doing experiments and discovered that if you slice up the sheet a certain way, it actually equalizes its frequency response a little bit. Gets rid of that low mid oomph that you would hear if a whole room is done with 703. And it's just wall to wall, and you walk in, it kind of sounds like this. And if you cut them up, it balances out quite a lot. I didn't coin the term, but Ken called it pazification, after my last name being Paz. And so I went and presented it to the Sapphire Group, talked about it for 20 minutes. Everyone's like skeptical faces. Yeah, sure, whatever. And then I took a sheet of 703, put a mic to it, drummed on it, took another one, sliced up, drummed on it. Boom, boom, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, responding to the difference. At this point, I started building panels, designing my own panels, and really going after how, like I said before, how do I make this simple? And so I need something that can be done in a day. I need something where I need to streamline the efficiency of both manufacturing on the back end, but also the installation process. You know, something that takes 15 minutes needs to take 30 seconds. A string of decision making about where things should be needs to be kind of essentially A, B, or C, not how do I do this now, and starting to do sketches. And now I think we're sort of caught up.
Wow. That's quite a story.
Sorry if I was too elaborate.
That's good. You know, you mentioned along the way here about business and getting your business chops together. So this is my last question for you. What's the best piece of advice and it could be about business or it could be about anything, could be about acoustics that you've either learned along the way or maybe someone imparted to you.
Well, a good piece of advice I see consistently around me is it's easy to get stuck in loops that are kind of like a distraction. And this answer is very unsatisfying. Don't get stuck in distractions. That's not what I'm saying. It's easy to get stuck in loops. They're like, leave it alone. Do the thing you wanted to do. Like something I see often, right? I implement a studio. And, you know, beyond the acoustics, we also dive into all the other decisions of the studio. What desk you should get. You know, let's design your signal flow so that it serves your workflow and removes tasks on the moment or removes the gradation or whatever else that I can, you know, make better. And, you know, we'll go through this process and make the studio like cater it to the workflow of the person, the producer. And now it's easy for them to work and it sounds great. And the decisions translate. And now a mix that took 3 days takes, you know, 1 day or one sitting. Great. Fantastic advancement. And then after that, they're still adding things and they're still exploring new gear. And they're, what if I change the cables here to this? And what about these new settings? It's like, leave it alone. Make music. You wanted to make music. Don't make a studio. I make a studio. I barely make music these days. I keep my Saturdays with one client that became a friend that I engineer and produce. And, you know, that's something I like. It's for me. Obviously, there's business involved, but it's for me. But other than that, my day-to-day is building a company and figuring out marketing and how to handle the ups and downs and waves and payroll and how do I make sure we don't lose money if in this manufacturing process? How do I take something that took an hour and a half and cut it down to a minute and a half? And a whole bunch of how do I make the brand communicate what it needs to? And all these things are not making music. And that's fine. I chose this path. But a customer for me or a producer engineer who works under studio and then achieves a space that enables them to do what they want to do, put it aside now and do what you came to do. It takes a lot of mental effort to switch modes off of one day thinking. It's like my studio is not good enough. I need to work on the work environment. Into this is good. This is the time. This is the place. Now let's go back into actually why I started. And so I guess my one piece of advice is keep your eye on the prize and discern what is necessary and contributory and what is now just habit. I'm like still dealing with something out of habit. Is that a good answer?
That's great. That's a good place to stop, I think. Thank you so much, Hush. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.